Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In a world filled with angry, shouting pundits, The New Yorker's Hendrik Hertzberg doesn't yell in his talk of the town political essays. That doesn't mean that he doesn't convey outrage or rip into a fresh hypocrisy. He just takes aim with lucid calm and wit. And the bullseye is almost always, but not always, the American right. Tonight on Point, Hendrik Hertzberg on the Bush years, red and blue America, and the liberal mind. But first, we begin tonight in Iraq, where clashes have intensified as U.S. troops again fight militants loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr around the Imam Ali Shrine in Najaf. Today, a U.S. warplane bombed near Najaf Cemetery, and al-Sadr reportedly refused to meet with a delegation of Iraqis hoping to persuade him and his militia to evacuate the shrine. Earlier, I spoke with Christian Science Monitor reporter Scott Baldoff, who spent the last few days in Najaf. I asked him to describe the latest developments in the clashes around the shrine.
I just talked with somebody near the shrine, actually, who was inside the shrine. He was saying that the fighting is ongoing right now on all sides, north, south, east, west, from around the shrine. Rounds are coming into the shrine itself, and many of the wounded, or as he said, pieces of the wounded, are being brought in for whatever treatment they can possibly give. It seems that the negotiations at this point are not bearing any fruit. There is very little for Sadr to bite into in terms of the actual offers. Basically, Sadr was told to disarm, to leave the shrine, and that the shrine would be handed over to the Iraqi government authority, which all three of those would be an affront to him. He would like the shrine to remain in the hands of at least the Shiite religious authority rather than going into government hands. And as for disarming, that would be the end of his movement if it were to happen.
But he was reportedly also offered amnesty along with his militiamen. If that's being rejected, are we moving at long last into a kind of end game here, into a final battle?
Well, it certainly does look like that. In the last 24 hours, we've seen the Americans move within, it now appears they're within 100 meters of the shrine, certainly within striking distance. If they wanted to pulverize it with tanks, they could do it. That's not likely to happen. What's more likely to happen is a long, protracted siege that would force these militiamen to starve or come out completely humiliated. That is the way that things do appear to be moving at this point.
Scott, the drama in Najaf appears to have overshadowed, perhaps even derailed, the big national conference. 1,300 Iraqis from across the country meeting in Baghdad, supposed to be laying down the rails for a move toward democracy. What's been the impact of the Najaf conflict on that meeting?
Well, as you say, it has overshadowed it. I think, number one, very little attention is given to it by the media. This was going to be essentially their, not quite a constitutional Congress, but the chance for them to choose the next assembly. And very few Iraqis, of course, see this as adding any legitimacy to a government that they see as being imposed by the United States. But that said, if there is a very strong military stand taken against this militia, Muqtada al-Sadr, it could, in theory, bolster the legitimacy and the authority of the government of Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. He would be seen as, for once, being able to take on a militia movement within his territory and bring that at least one city under his control.
As we talk tonight then, Scott, is it all still up in the air? Who's going to end up coming out appearing to be winning from this standoff? Is it still on the knife's edge?
Well, it is. It is, definitely. Unfortunately, at least from the perspective of Iyad Alawi, it's hard to see how he personally wins out of this. The psychology of this particular movement of Shiite radicals, the Mehdi army, it seems to grow. as the Mehdi army in Najaf gets closer to defeat. The movement has thousands of followers around the country, particularly down in the south where the Shiite majority reside. And there have been sporadic outbreaks of violence in a number of cities, including Basra, which is a key oil town where 90% of the nation's oil goes out to foreign markets from that town alone, and other oil-producing towns like Amara and so on. As he brings one city under his control, Mr. Alawi, others could slip out of his hands. And that is a real danger for this government.
And, Scott, it's hard from here in the States to keep track of what exactly is at stake in this rolling conflict. How would you sum it up as you look on tonight?
Well, I think there are two visions here. You've got, on one hand, the vision of the Alawi government of presumably a secular democratic government on one hand, and then the vision of Muqtadir al-Sadr is one where they would like to see the rule of Sharia, which is, of course, the Islamic legal system that many Muslims, particularly religious ones, would like to see in Iraq. But between theocracy and democracy, there's a big, big gap. And unfortunately, it's not one that this government knows quite how to come to grips with.
Scott Baldoff, thanks for joining us there.
Thank you.
Scott Baldoff is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me from Baghdad. When Hendrik Hertzberg was managing editor of the Harvard Crimson years ago, his professors barely saw him. He's led an undergraduate-style schedule ever since, writing late into the night at The New Yorker and before that The New Republic, as cleaning staff nodded a familiar hello and swept up around him. During his time at The New Republic, including two stints as editor in the 1980s, the magazine became the must-read of Washington insiders. 20 copies were shipped directly to the Reagan White House from the presses every week. When Hertzberg returned to The New Yorker in 1992, he confirmed his place as one of the most prominent voices of the liberal intellect in America. His new book, Politics, Observations and Arguments, 1966 to 2004, is a collection of some of his best writing. What Hertzberg may do best is expose a political cruelty or political hypocrisy, and he does it with a stylish, funny, civilized pen. Tonight on Point, Hendrik Hertzberg on the Bush years, red and blue America, and the liberal mind today. Are you a Hendrik Hertzberg fan? Does the political voice of The New Yorker speak for you? Is it Greek to you? And how much throw weight does it have today beyond the Hudson River, beyond the blue coasts? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Hendrik Hertzberg, political essayist for The New Yorker magazine. He frequently writes the Talk of the Town section under the heading Comment. He's former editor of The New Republic magazine and was a speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter. His new book is entitled Politics. Hendrik Hertzberg, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly magazine. And full disclosure, Jack, an old colleague of Rick Hertzberg's at The New Republic.
Yes, and a very, very warm admirer. Rick, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show.
It's so great to be on with you, Jack.
it's great to have everybody here. Rick Hertzberg, we really want to take advantage of your time and mine tonight. You've put together a terrific collection of columns from over a long, long time, representing a very distinctive angle of thinking and certainly of expression in American politics and culture these days. Let's get right to big stuff with you. Try this one on for size. We've been batting around the table here how to define exactly what this sort of meta contest is that's underway in America right now in this presidential campaign. You know, red and blue is too easy. When you look out on the assembled forces or mindsets that appear to be squaring off in this campaign with George W. Bush at the head of one and John Kerry at the head of the other, what's the big American conflict of perspective that's playing out here?
Wow, big question. There's a ruling coalition on one side, similar in a way, at least in its sort of meta shape, to the old New Deal coalition, in that it's a disparate collection of people who don't all have the same agenda. That's the Bush coalition. And on the other side, there is an increasingly disciplined opposition, which, however, is also somewhat splintered. It's a titanic battle, but that's for all kinds of reasons. And it does have an Armageddon-like feeling about it, certainly, more than any other election I can remember.
It does. And, of course, you know, we see that coalition on the one side, the religious right, the neocons, the traditional conservatives. On the other side, Democrats all getting together under their banners. We're not sure if you're the right guy to ask about red and blue here, remembering Pauline Kael, what she was reported to have said after Richard Nixon was elected. How did Nixon get elected? I don't know anyone who voted for him, and I don't know how much you associate with the Republican red part of the culture. But get behind the coalition and the Democratic solid front this year. What is in these the worldviews, the perspectives? What makes up these two sides? The interest, is it values based, experience, fear versus hope? Get under the skin of these two.
Well, without oversimplifying too much, at least with oversimplifying too much, because there's no other way to characterize these things. One side is essentially secular, for example. That doesn't mean it's irreligious. It doesn't mean that there are plenty of people on that side, i.e. the Democratic side, who go to church, believe in God, consider themselves practicing whatever religion they practice. But in terms of their political perspective, they are secularists, and they believe in the separation of church and state. On the other side are, non-secularists. They're fundamentalists, I guess, many of them. As you say, I don't know an awful lot of them and can't speak for them, but I try to keep my hand in. And that is certainly a big part of the Bush coalition, and it's one that doesn't sit entirely comfortably with other parts of the Bush coalition. There's also the, what you might call on the Bush side, the economic royalists. I'm baffled myself at what is behind Republican tax and fiscal policy in terms of values. I've always been puzzled about what it is that makes people proud to be in favor of taking from the poor to give to the rich. It's just beyond me. I don't really get it. But that's certainly another large part of that coalition.
And the troops pulled up almost in battle lines for kind of Armageddon, or at least it feels that way sometimes. Jack Beatty, here's a guy who has put the scalpel in from so many angles over the years, very consistent in the political point of view, but always looking to illuminate, not in the angry shout fashion, but in a more old-fashioned liberal style.
Yes, and wry and witty and felicitous writer. So he charms as well as instructs. But let me just take a crack at that red and white thing, Tom, for a second. I have a sort of sample on this. I wake to the antiphony of blue and red America. That is, I wake to Washington Journal on C-SPAN. I watch it every day. For an hour or more, I listen to it, and it's callers calling in, bashing Bush, bashing Kerry. And so that's my sample. And here's how I see it dividing up, and maybe this is just essentially repeating what Rick says in another way, but I see it as the difference between the evidence of things unseen and evidence. when the Democrats call up, they say, no evidence, no WMD, no Al-Qaeda, that sort of thing. Well, when a Republican calls up, he says, Saddam was a cruel dictator. It was the right thing to do. The world is better off. Well, I guess Saddam, that isn't evidence unseen. He was a cruel dictator. But the other things are statements of value, of belief. Or, for example, if you're talking about tax cuts, Democrat will call up and say, tax cuts have gone mostly to the top 1%. Well, the Republican calls up and says, yes, but you know, that's those people's money. That's not the government's money. People know what to do with their own money better than the government. Well, that's, again, a sort of statement of belief, of of, you know, this is just the way things are. So you get this kind of, again, evidence of things unseen versus evidence.
Evidence, secularists, non-secularists. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with New Yorker political essayist Rick Hertzberg about the Bush years, red and blue America, and the liberal mind today. You can join the conversation. Are you a Hertzberg fan? Does the political voice of the New Yorker speak for you? How much throw weight does it have beyond the Hudson? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New Yorker political essayist Hendrik Hertzberg. His new book is Politics, Observations and Arguments, 1966 to 2004, a compilation of some of his best writing over those many years, now at the New Yorker magazine, former editor of the New Republic, former speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter. You can join the conversation tonight. How does the measured voice of the liberal conscience, the liberal intellect, stand up to the likes of Limbaugh and O'Reilly? Has political discourse become so coarse that Hertzberg can't be heard? Or after 4 years of George Bush, is America ready to listen? Do you share Hendrik Hertzberg's secular humanist worries about the influence of religion on American politics today? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rick Hertzberg, it's funny to hear you put it right away in terms of secularists and non-secularists, and we've got the Armageddon, the troops lined up for the campaign. I wonder how seriously you mean that. How, I suppose, from your perspective, the threat of those anti-secular humanist folks out there is, you know, do we have a kind of struggle over whether the United States will continue to be fundamentally a secular country with strong religious surround rather than something else?
Well, I'm not really that worried about the prospect of our becoming a theocracy. What I'm really more talking about is a kind of quality of mind, and that's something that goes beyond the religious right. There's a sort of ideological rapture that has gripped the Republican Party in all its aspects, and it takes different forms in different parts of the Republican Party. The neoconservatives have a kind of ideological rapture, and they took us into this war in Iraq on that basis, really without much knowledge of or interest in the peculiarities of Iraq or what might actually happen in Iraq or who the Iraqis really are, but on the basis of an ideological generalization, an admirable one in some ways. I mean, they believe in democracy, and I have no quarrel with that, and I share with them the hope that Iraq will become a democratic country someday. But is it wise policy to base going to war on ideological generalizations rather than, or in addition to, looking at the peculiarities and the particulars of a strategic situation? I don't think so.
But do I hear you suggesting there that there's an ideological rapture on the other side of the divide as well?
I think there's a good deal less of one. Of course, there is an element on the left that automatically believes that everything wrong in the world is somehow the fault of America or big American corporations or big multinational corporations or some other big sinister force that is manipulating everything. But I think that's a pretty marginal tendency in the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is not free of ideology, of course, but I think it's become the more pragmatic of the two parties in both in foreign policy and in domestic policy.
Rick Hertzberg, you wrestle a lot with religion in this collection of your essays. There's this wonderful line, where is it written that if you don't like religion, you're somehow disqualified from being a legitimate American? What was Mark Twain, a Russian? It's just terrific. And it goes to the wit point. You've got kind of an unusual background on this front yourself. Your dad, I guess, a non-observant Jew. Your mother, a Quaker, distant cousin of Walt Whitman. How did you come around to your own sense of religiosity or lack thereof and your understanding of the appropriate relationship between religiosity and American political life?
Well, I'm not sure. I've gone through, I've thought a lot about religion from many, many different angles. I was not brought up in any religious tradition or in any dogmatic religious tradition, but with familiarity with a lot of religious traditions. And I think they all have their beauty and they all have their advantage. And I think you can have a sense of the sacred and you can have a sense of the holy without having much sense of a supernatural power that interferes in daily life. Many of the people I know who consider themselves religious, who are observantly religious, who go to mass or who go to synagogue, or when you talk to them at length about what they really believe, they turn out to be more or less deists. I mean, they believe in a God. They believe in a God as a kind of prime mover and as a sort of mystical presence, but not a God who decides who's going to win the Oklahoma-Texas football game, or for that matter, any of the wars that people conduct against each other.
Sure, it's not that literal, but then, you know, there's the famous New Yorker cartoon that shows the map with Manhattan and filling the entire foreground and all the rest of the planet minute in the distance. Somewhere out there in that distance, I've got a bunch of relatives who now, in their homes, discourage children from talking about Darwin and evolution, who tune in daily to radio shows that absolutely go on tirades against secular humanism, something I was educated to embrace and hold up. That's a pretty, and these are not fringe people in their communities by any stretch of the imagination. That's a pretty big canyon between that mentality and yours.
It is, and I think there's a new kind of silent majority in the country. You might call it a silent majority of deists or of non-fundamentalists. The conversation about religion in America has lost a lot of its vitality over the past. Well, century, really. If you go back 100 years, or 150 years for that matter, to the mid-19th century, you had enormous amounts of religious revivalism and fundamentalism and tent shows and on the one hand, and you also had free thinkers and lecturers who would go around the country questioning religion, even ridiculing religion, and a man like Robert Ingersoll, who was one of the most prominent Republicans of the last half of the 19th century, was one of the most famous men in America. His fame derived from going around denouncing religion, and he was also an extremely popular speaker at Republican conventions. He's the one who nominated James G. Blaine for president at the Republican convention. Can you imagine that now?
No, I can't.
I think there was.
But the first half of that equation has certainly not gone away. The tent meetings, maybe they've traveled to television and megachurches, but they're certainly still underway.
Yes, they are. But there's a sort of a they benefit from the political correctness pall. It's not polite to actually discuss the substance of their beliefs. Nobody asked George Bush, for example, nobody tries to nail him down on whether he thinks the Earth is 5,000 years old, as many fundamentalists claim, or whether he thinks it's billions of years old, as science tells us. Nobody tries to find out what he really believes about the rapture and about the idea that believers are going to be snatched up one day into the sky, and if a believer happens to be piloting the plane you're on, just hope one of the passengers is not religious and knows how to fly a plane.
No, so you're saying it's just not polite to ask about that anymore, or certainly to ridicule.
It's not even polite to suggest that it might be a legitimate thing to ask a public figure. It's legitimate if the public figure is irreligious or insufficiently religious or insufficiently observant in some way. It seems to be okay to hammer at that, but not to discuss the substance and the political implications of the religious beliefs of public figures.
There's a lot more we want to talk about. We're joined tonight by New Yorker political essayist Hendrik Hertzberg. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Renata's calling from New York City. Hi, Renata. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, I just wanted to say I adore Hendrik Hertzberg. I think I'm one of your biggest fans. And one reason is that I think there's a sort of a common sense American-ness to your commentaries that I think you don't find in some of the European commentators and also in a lot of the American commentaries that you read out there. And you know, you were talking about ideology earlier, and I think that that's what's so refreshing about a lot of what The New Yorker prints. And also I think it's absolutely completely relevant, not just for New Yorkers, but for everybody else in the country. I know a lot of people that, you know, are very excited when Hendrik Hertzberg writes in The New Yorker and very upset when his commentaries don't appear. So,
and Renata, let me ask you, it's relevant. How much does it sway the current political conversation in this country? How influential do you think it is today?
Particularly his commentary?
Yes.
Well, I can only speak for myself, but I think that it's quite influential. I mean, I find myself discussing what he's talked about or what he writes about with my father, with my friends, and, you know, I find it very, very helpful.
So definitely grist for your mill, a big fan there in New York. Renata, thanks for calling. Rick Hertzberg, what about this? Do you feel yourself consciously sort of naked on the ideological front lately? When people wear ideology so heavy, when they lead with it so often, you are seen as somebody certainly has it, but keeps it, you know, somewhere behind the thoughts that are leading a particular essay.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious where I stand. I'm very, very lucky to work for the magazine I work for any number of reasons. And one of the reasons is that it isn't a magazine that is completely preaching to the choir. The New Yorker has a lot of arrows in its quiver. It's got politics, but it's got arts, it's got fiction, it's got poetry, it's got cartoons. And an awful lot of people who read The New Yorker are not East Coast liberals. Or even West Coast liberals. Some of them are Midwest liberals. No, there are also plenty of conservatives.
Sure.
Believe me, because I hear from quite a few of them, and I am conscious of trying to write in a way that will at least get a hearing from them. I mean, partly I try to do that by giving them a joke now and then, something to chuckle at.
Yeah.
And partly by actually trying to take their ideas more or less seriously, although sometimes I do, admittedly, I can't resist resorting to ridicule sometimes.
Jack, what do you make of this time we're living in where people, you know, put their ideology front and center, they come out with the heavy armor every time? Rick Hertzberg on a different path here, again, a sort of an older-fashioned path in a way that relies on a line of thinking, a line of reasoning, rather than the sort of straight, full-on ideological attack. Does that work today? Is the culture ready for that maybe to be more influential, or do you have to be large and in charge and ideological to sway?
Well, it does seem to work, and we're going to see in this election. I can't think of a less ideological candidate than John Kerry. You know, what I'm struck with, again, this may just be too psychological an observation about a political phenomenon, but I'm struck with the way ideology bleaches out ambivalence, that it takes out the skepticism that we feel even about our own ideas, much less someone else's. And it replaces it with, as I said earlier, something like faith, that this is right. And to have that orientation to things, it's a little bit like, you know, the difference between facts and statements about facts and statements about values. They're really in different languages. And that's what I keep encountering all the time, that the great advantage of ideology or Republican, that worldview, is that it starts out with right and with morality and the hell with the facts. Because it's as if to say, if your heart is pure, or someone said the other day at a Bush rally, God is in the White House. If God is in the White House, that's all they need. And the ambivalence that liberals reflect about the country, that this isn't the greatest country in the world, that we have tremendous problems, that judged against our potential, we're in fact a cruel country to the poor. We scorn them. We profess to be Christians, but we're the least Christian, you know, judged in terms of our charity to the poor, the least Christian country on earth. All of that stuff just can't come into the mind of your of your 100%er. It's, I won't look at the country that way, and you do. That's because you're tearing down the country.
Mm-hmm. And yet there's a lot of people who use that to build a fortress against a more liberal way of thinking, and maybe do it on purpose, maybe with a political purpose. Anne is calling from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Anne, what do you think?
Hi. Usually I feel like I'm preaching to the choir because I'm born and raised in Massachusetts. And, of course, I'm a John Kerry supporter. But recently went to on a trip to Western United States. And whether I met a Texan in Fresno or somebody, a Christian who calls himself a Christian from Louisiana on Rodeo Drive,
yeah.
The one thing I asked was, can you give me a reason why you would vote for George Bush? And they, this is where it ends for them. I'm a Christian, I don't believe in abortion, and I'm voting for President Bush. And it's just really hard for me to believe that you would ask them, oh, have you seen that movie, Fahrenheit 9/11? Because in my opinion, I did see that movie, and it was news clips from the media I watched, CNN, MSNBC.
Yeah.
They said, oh, no, that was all lies. And I said, how can that be? Oh, because the media is liberal. The argument just ends right there for them. And I guess I'm really concerned that how, you know, we have 50% of the country going to vote for George Bush. And all I can ever say is we need to keep religion and state separate. And you want to know why? Because look at the Middle East.
And you don't want to go there. And we've got it. And thanks for your call, Rick Hertzberg. There it is again, that concern that somehow the camps really are on different beams. And we've got a problem here, Houston.
Well, liberals, I think it's fair to say that 30, 40, 50 years ago, the situation was more or less reversed, where it was liberals who had the feeling of certainty and that they had all the answers.
Yeah.
Liberals have taken an awful lot of beating since then. And in many ways it's weakened them, but in this one way it may have strengthened them by making them more skeptical, by making them a little more less ready to accept given received ideas, even their own received ideas. And this strength, this alleged strength of the right, that it has all the answers, that it's absolutely certain of everything, is. It can be a very brittle kind of strength. I mean, the right-wing propaganda machine, the Fox News magazines, the talk radio juggernaut, all of these things, as an old student of the old left, remind me of the Soviet propaganda machine. And where similarly there were the simple answers, and where there were the line was put out, and everybody sang, everybody was on the same page, everybody sang the same hymn, and it turned out to be a paper tiger. I mean, it was brittle, and I maybe this may be a totally crazy Pollyannish thing to hope, but I think this fever could conceivably break at some point. This kind of right wing fever could conceivably break sometime in the future. Liberals are trying to found their own institutions to help it along belatedly, and who knows, something good might happen in the future.
Could happen. Much more to get into. Rick Hertzberg, please stand by. We're talking with New Yorker political essayist Hendrik Hertzberg. His new book is Politics. You can join the conversation. What's your question for the political voice of The New Yorker magazine? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New Yorker political essayist Hendrik Hertzberg. His new book is Politics, Observations and Arguments, 1966-2004. We're looking at the Bush years, red and blue America, and a liberal mind today. You can join the conversation. Can we reason our way to consensus anymore? Or are the bridges just down between red and blue America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rick Hertzberg, there's a moment that I've always seen. Maybe this is looking back through the prism of the Reagan years historically. But there was Jimmy Carter's famous speech, July 20th, 1979. It came to be known as the Malaise Speech, where he kind of lectured and hectored and appealed to Americans to think about how they lived and maybe change their ways. I guess the word malaise wasn't in it, but it quickly got that tag. Looking back through the Reagan, the sort of can-do, it's morning in America years, it always seemed to me that that speech was in a way itself a turning point. The Republican response was so strong that Americans are not to be addressed in that fashion. They're to be addressed only in terms of how great they are, to be flattered and to be cajoled that way into great things. You wrote that speech, and I wonder if you ever look back on it, for all the praise it got at the time, as a kind of a political mistake that gave the Reagan view a giant opening to charge through and occupy.
Well, it would be more accurate to say that I typed that speech. It had multiple authors. I wasn't even the primary one. Jimmy Carter was the primary one, and so was Patrick Cadell, the volatile pollster, and numerous other people had input into it. Nevertheless, it's a speech that I defend as a piece of writing, as a diagnosis of what was wrong with the country. I think you're right. It was a political blunder, largely because Carter, having diagnosed what was wrong with the country fairly accurately, I think, as a crisis of confidence in our institutions and in ourselves, didn't really have the answer. And when you're president, you're in the business of providing answers, not simply in diagnosing problems. So I think you're right. It was a political mistake that kind of gave realism and sacrifice a bad name for a long time and plunged us into this period of mindless optimism, where even now, even as late as 2004, the candidates compete to see who can sound more optimistic and to claim the label of optimist, even when optimism is a highly inappropriate response to reality.
Well, let's stick with that fast forward then and look for a moment at John Kerry. The Democratic Convention was very big on hope and positive message. But if part of the presidential role is having the answers, how do you rate John Kerry in terms of communicating to the electorate that he's the man with the plan compared to George Bush?
I don't know. I don't really have a strong opinion on that question. I mean, I think he's doing okay. I think we know who John Kerry is, and we know what's right with him and what's wrong with him. And he's somebody who's spent many, many years thinking about public policy. I think he's extremely well prepared to be president. I think he has the character for the job, above all, the character for the job. And no, I don't suppose he has an easily bumper-stickable plan to save the world and save the nation. But I think that as president, he'd be pretty good at making sound and responsible decisions, and that's a great deal more than could be said for the current crew.
Are you disappointed that he's not engendering more enthusiasm? A lot of solidarity behind John Kerry, but a big portion of it is clearly anybody but Bush driven.
Yes, and I think that's rational. No, I'm not disappointed, and I think that this is said, by the way, of virtually every candidate for president, especially Democratic candidates for president. It was said of Bill Clinton, too, in 1992. It was said of Jimmy Carter. It was said of Harry Truman. It was said of Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1932.
But Bill Clinton had a kind of, I don't know, intellectual and animal charm that you could feel when you saw him, something other than John Kerry's got.
Yes, but John Kerry has something else, something other than what Bill Clinton had. Mm. John Kerry has the moral authority that goes with having passed with flying colors the moral tests of his generation, both the test of serving and the test of protesting. And he's formal, yes, he's formal. People perceive him as being a bit standoffish. These are qualities in a backslapper may not be desirable, but I think in a president of the United States at a particularly grim and serious time in our history, they're not bad qualities to have.
Joseph's calling from New York. Hi, Joseph. You're on the air.
Hello there. I have a question for you that slightly off topic, but also relates to the piece that you wrote for The New Yorker having to do with the early and almost botched operation in Afghanistan, which I found quite interesting, also showed, at least to me, that you spoke with many people who were in the military and they spoke their minds to you a little bit. And I'm curious, what does the military think of the Bush administration's policy? Do you have a sense of that, what the Army, which after all is an important force in most societies, even if we deny it, what they think of what Bush has been doing?
Joseph, you're breaking up, but we hear it there, the question being, presuming, Rick Hertzberg, that from reading you, that you've got some decent military contacts and what you hear from them, if that's true, about the war in Iraq.
Well, he may be speaking more generally of the New Yorker's coverage of the war. I think that the military is less monolithic in this election than it has been in some elections past. You know, we now have a kind of a bipartite military. I mean, there's an officer class that is overwhelmingly, but not entirely, Republican, and enlisted men and women whose political allegiance is probably also on the whole Republican, but much more up for grabs. And the military is not all that happy, from what I can see, with this administration for a variety of reasons. But I would not pretend to be an expert on this subject.
Jack Beatty, here we are, Rick Hertzberg, just for a couple minutes more. And you've heard him go over the waterfront from red and blue to John Kerry. He's more generous on John Kerry than I've heard you, Jack.
Well, yes, I think he is, and I'm glad to hear him instruct us in fair-mindedness. I just couldn't get over Kerry's. I just still can't get over Kerry's political vote for this war, Rick. He was put on Earth. His political purpose was to stand up and say never again send young kids from Kansas and the Bronx to this
as the Vietnam vet in this.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's what he was shaped to say, and I feel that he said, "Take that cup away from me. I've I got to run for president." And I understand these things are done, but by gosh, this is people's lives.
Rick Hertzberg, a lapse there?
No, I don't think so. I think the bigger question is, would Kerry have done it the same way if he were actually president? Would we be in the same fix if Kerry had been president? I really, really don't think so. And I don't think we'd be in the same fix if Gore had been allowed to take office as president. And to me, that's the large, the huge, gigantic elephant of a question that we shouldn't get too distracted away from. I think his vote for authorizing force was defensible. Had the Senate denied that authority at that point, then the strategy that Kerry wanted to follow, and the one that I think made most sense, which was to keep the pressure on Saddam Hussein and force him into a corner, make him give way to the inspections, that strategy would have collapsed if the club of possible military action had been lifted. So I think it's a very defensible vote, and one that is not at all incompatible with the idea that if he were president, we'd be in a much, much better fix than we're in right now.
Hendrik Hertzberg, with that, we're out of time. We thank you for joining us tonight. It's been great having you. Thanks so much for coming on.
And thanks, and it's great to be with Jack.
Good to be with you, Rick.
Old home week. Hendrik Hertzberg, his new book is Politics. In a moment, one voter explains why she's still undecided on her pick for president. This is On Point. George Bush and John Kerry have continued to campaign through battleground states this week as the presidential campaign nears the fall stretch. Bush spoke in Pennsylvania and West Virginia today, while Kerry traveled to Ohio. Both are hoping to win over the small percentage of voters who have yet to commit to one candidate or the other. According to polls, the portion of undecided voters is unusually low this election, somewhere between 3% and 7% of the electorate. South Carolina resident Kathleen Parker is among those undecided voters. In this radio diary, she explains why she remains undecided despite the deep partisanship that swirls around her.
Independent voters are variously beloved or maligned, courted or ignored, depending on how the political pendulum swings. Lately, as partisanship approaches nuclear fission, independents are held in contempt by some who see them as not fully engaged or as wishy-washy or ignorant. A recent story about the respective strategies of President Bush and Senator Kerry noted that both were focusing on their party bases rather than wasting time on swing voters. That's a mistake, and I should know. I'm one of those independent swing voters. I haven't made up my mind yet. It's a fact that I've supported the war in Iraq and agree with some but not all Bush policies, but it's not a fact that I routinely vote Republican. I'm no more comfortable with Jerry Falwell than I am with Michael Moore, except that I suspect Falwell has better table manners. I may vote for John Kerry come November. Then again, I may not. Am I indecisive? Wishy-washy? Disengaged? No, I'm merely undecided and suspect I'm not atypical of other voters who are neither Republican nor Democrat, but first and foremost American. I'm a consummate post-9/11 American who, despite interest in other areas, will vote for the individual I believe will best ensure that I'm around to vote again in 2008. Will it be Bush or Kerry? There's still plenty of time for much to change. Another attack, good news or bad from Iraq, saber-rattling or diplomatic intentions from other questionable states. Some days Bush seems to have things in hand, but it's impossible to ignore America's damaged unity as well as our tarnished international standing. As for which man I can tolerate listening to for the next 4 years, the answer is neither. If Bush's tongue-tangling yokelism keeps my thumb close to the mute button, Kerry's first-person oracular, in which even the insignificant is endowed with gravitas, sends me lurching for the corkscrew. I only drink, as critic George G. Nathan once put it, to make other people seem more interesting. In saner times, I wouldn't consider voting for the most liberal member of the U.S. Senate, but these are not sane times. Any tilt toward Kerry now would be predicated on the possibility that changing the face in the White House might help secure our future by altering the tempo, muting our tom-toms, and injecting a little, dare I say the word, nuance into our national persona. Bush bashing, disappointingly, if not tragically, has taken on a life of its own, such that internal partisanship now feels almost as threatening to our survival as our external enemies. We're ripe for a terrorist attack, yet we've become so stridently self-absorbed and distracted by partisan one-upmanship that you begin to wonder whether anyone's manning the barricades. The growth of the independent voter bloc in recent months, including some renegades from the Republican side, may be a product of that understanding. The gotcha spirit that distorts truth in the name of our team is tiresome, childish, and potentially deadly. What adult wants to waste another minute on the rantings of conventioneers in our midst? When it comes to partisanship, no one gets a pass. Everybody's guilty of me-ism at the expense of what may be best for the country. When the far left finds its Lancelot in the dishonest propagandizing of a Michael Moore, and the far right finds solace in, well, at least we don't behead people, we know that the level of discourse has been lowered beyond what civilization can safely tolerate. The stakes are too high to leave politics to partisans. Independents like me have figured that out.
Kathleen Parker is a columnist with the Tribune Media Services. She lives in Columbia, South Carolina. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakravarti, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Jane Manners, Tamar Morad, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Tim Skoog, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.